Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a corrected address, but you have a fire in a one story ordinary. Looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control. Squad 5, squad 5. Angle to 273, 273. Angle battalion, 18, 18 battalion. With the 273, 273.
Welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. Tonight, we're having only two of us, of the four of us. So Chip Comstock from Ohio is a fire chief and an attorney at law. And I am a retired deputy fire chief and attorney at law out here in Washington State. And ordinarily, we have Brad Pinsky from New York, who's the fire chief of Manlius Fire in upstate New York, and who's at a meeting tonight. And then we have Kurt Verone from Providence, Rhode Island, who's a retired assistant deputy chief in Providence and also is a, I think it's fire chief or a deputy chief in Exeter, Rhode Island. So he's keeping his fire service legacy alive. So tonight we have sort of a cornucopia, I guess, of legal issues, things that both Chip and I, when we do our research online, and tonight we're actually prepared for the presentation, which is sort of an unusual event because we usually do these on the fly. But I think there are some, at least three, if not four, good cases that are important to you as firefighters and fire officers, and certainly important to the fire lawyers who represent fire departments and fire districts across the state and firefighters. But before I start, there's a couple of housekeeping items. First of all, we'd like to thank Enwell and Fire Engineering for hosting these, and we also like to thank Honeywell for not only sponsoring the blog radio shows, but also providing scholarships to this year's FDIC in Indianapolis the week of April 24th, where both Chip and I are speaking, as is Kurt Verone and Brad Pinsky. So you're going to get the lawyers live and in person, but there's Honeywell has given us Fire Engineering some scholarships to about, I think, 25 individuals have the opportunity to go to FDIC, which is probably one of the best training events in the country. The other shout-out I'd like to give is to Honeywell, because of their sponsorships and their support of the fire service over the years. And certainly we're all familiar with the Honeywell products and brand, and we just, again, like to thank them very much for their participation in our show. And then before we actually get started in any serious legal discussion between Chip and myself, while we're looking at Kurt's blog, which I'm going to give a cheap shout out to, but Kurt Verone does a fire law blog, which is pretty amazing in its complexity and its the types of cases that he does research on and provides information on. But this one caught my eye today, which is kind of funny, which, you know, you always would wish this to happen to an attorney, but it never does. And so its caption is, "Defense attorney's pants catch on fire during an arson trial," which I thought was pretty funny. And it reads, "An attorney defending an accused arsonist and a mishap during his closing argument when his pants caught fire." And so what he was arguing was that the his client was innocent because the fire was the result of spontaneous combustion, and while he's giving his argument, which probably lent some credibility into his closing argument, his own pants catch on fire. And I think for attorneys, we get the humor. So anyway, without further ado, and trying to leave our comic relief behind, I don't know where Chip wants to start out, but so just stand by for a second here. I got to close this off. There we go. That was on Kurt's side and a little musical background. Hopefully you did not hear that. So anyway, one of the things we're going to talk about is presumptive illness. And I know that this has been a huge issue for firefighters across the country where, you know, what you collectively collect during your time as a firefighter. Sometimes it turns into heart disease, respiratory disease, cancers, and other sort of hazards of our job. There's been some, and I'm not sure what the statistics are, but a significant number of firefighters developing cancers as a result of exposure while working on your job as firefighters. So several states have put into play presumptive laws. And so I think Chip's going to talk about Ohio and maybe Pennsylvania, but in the state of Washington, under the revised code of Washington, 5132-185, entitled Occupational Diseases, Presumption of Occupational Diseases for Firefighters, and some of the limitations that go along with that, it talks about specific cancers, infectious diseases are considered under the RCW to be presumptive, and they talk about what you do in your lifestyle. So if you have developed an illness as a result of your occupational exposures, there's also a kind of a presumption that, did you cause your own diseases? And so and we've been preaching this for years, and I know that other shows, the fitness shows and those sorts of things, nutrition talks about, healthy living, healthy lifestyle, don't smoke, engage in some physical fitness activities during your career as a firefighter will help lend some credibility to the fact that you have actually contracted or been exposed to carcinogens and other material that cause your cancers or your lung disease or your long-term medical issues down the road, either before you retire or after you retire. So in the Washington law, they define the presumption in this particular writing shall only apply to prostate cancer diagnosed prior to the age of 50, brain cancers, malignant melanomas, leukemias, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, bladder cancer, ureter cancer, colorectal cancer, and multiple myelomas, testicular cancer, and kidney cancer, which is a significant amount of different cancers we can, obtain during our career as firefighters. And we talk about the importance of wearing your breathing apparatus. We talk about the importance of decontamination at the end of every fire response or every sort of response that would get you exposed to some sort of chemical agent. We talk about washing your protective clothing, including your the head component, part of your helmets. Anything that has a fabric to it, you want to make sure that you wash it on a periodic basis to kind of eliminate a lot of these sort of cancers. One of the things I think is that firefighters have a terrible time in proving that, the cancer that they obtained or they're, developing was obtained on the job. So in Washington, and I'm going to let Chip talk about this in a second, but Washington has kind of taken that sort of presumptiveness away from you as a firefighter having to prove that you've obtained, been exposed to these sort of carcinogens and has developed a cancer as a result of that. But in spite of the RCW, which declares a presumption, our firefighters, and I know several of them, have had an enormous uphill battle in proving in the court of law that that their disease was arranged or acquired while they're on the job. There's a case in Bellevue, Washington, that I personally know both of these firefighters, and there are several other cases in the state of Washington where I'm familiar and know the firefighters who have cancer, have developed the cancer, and had to prove beyond reasonable doubt that their cancers were obtained on the job. And so the most recent case, which was a Bellevue Fire Department, Washington case, which was two of the firefighters, Del Spivey and Bill Larson, developed melanomas, which are skin cancers, in areas underneath their bunker clothing, so on their back and around their waistline. And so they filed a claim with Washington L&I, Labor and Industries, and through this whole process, their claims were essentially denied, the fact that this was a presumptive illness, that they had acquired this cancer while on the job, and that the fact that, the burden of proof shifted essentially from them to the employer. Like, there's the presumption that the employer hires expert witnesses and proves the fact that, this was not an on-the-job acquired cancer. And so there's this sort of seesaw battle that had gone back and forth between the fire department, the two firefighters, the Washington Department of Labor Industries, and then finally it makes it all the way up to our Supreme Court, which is our highest court in the state of Washington, and they decided in favor of the two firefighters. And so if you're interested in reading the case, it's a 32-page long case entitled Delmas Spivey and Wilford Larson versus the City of Bellevue and the Department of Labor and Industries. And then, and so without reading the entire case, which would probably even put me and Chip to sleep, I'm going to read the conclusion. So it says RCW 5132-185, which is the occupational disease, presumptive of occupational disease, reflects the legislature's intent to relieve a firefighter of unique problems of proving that firefighter caused his or her disease. Accordingly, we, the court, apply the firefighter's presumption with the force that gives life to the legislature's words. We hold that the question whether the city rebutted the presumption in RCW 51 is one of fact that may be submitted to the jury. In Spivey, the trial court erred when it decided the issue is a matter of law. We also clarify that RCW 51 shifts both the burden and the production and the burden of persuasion to the employer. Thus, in Larson, jury instruction number 9 accurately stated the applicable law. Finally, we find that Larson is entitled to attorney's fees for litigating a claim before the board and before this court. And so they affirm the Court of Appeals on Larson and reverse the court's trial ruling in Spivey and remand for proceedings in according with that decision. So in spite of the fact that, you know, both sides mounted up a ferocious campaign to either rebut the presumption or to prove the presumption, it was a tremendous cost, and I know this personally from talking to both of these gentlemen, that the emotional cost, the financial cost of these individuals is essentially unnecessary. And so when your community, and I know this has been a fact for other firefighters in the state of Washington, where their employer has essentially denied the fact that they were exposed to or contaminated while on the job. And I'm not sure whether that's the job of the city's attorney or the Board of Labor and Industries, but even though that there's enabling legislation in place, it's very difficult to prove the presumption. So just a word to the wise. Chip, I've rambled
on. I think, John, I think the first thing that so our readers are clear, and I think you explained it, but I'm going to just repeat it for a second. What has happened in the traditional workers' comp claim arena is that the employee has a burden of proof of showing that his or her injury or occupational illness, claimed occupational illness, arose during and out of the course of his or her employment. So, you know, if you're at work and you're working on a machine and your arm gets severed, or you end up in a hospital, you have medical bills, and you lose work, workers' comp is a no-fault system typically that will compensate the employee at a specified amount regardless of whether he or she was at fault. And so the employers don't have to show that they were not at fault, or the employee they don't have to look at who's at blame. But just the employee is compensated as long as that accident occurred during work time or out of the employment. It becomes a lot more difficult when we're talking about an illness as opposed to an injury. And so the illness aspect is, again, Was it incurred or did it as a result of the employment situation? Well, again, traditionally the employee has to establish that the illness resulted from his or her employment. And that's been very difficult to do. Again, it's much different than when you have a workplace injury. So the firefighters have started looking at statistics and have, you know, done a very good job, I think, nationally starting to track, you know, the incidence of cancer amongst firefighters. And what we've seen is that the firefighters have a significantly higher risk of contracting certain types of cancers than does the general workplace population. And so the legislatures have been approached in many states and have been asked to put in a presumption, a cancer presumption law. And what that says basically is instead of the employee having to prove that the illness, the cancer, arose during the course and scope of his or her employment, that's going to be presumed. It's going to be presumed that the firefighter contracted cancer, and it is now up to the employer to rebut that the cancer did not arise during the course and scope of the employment. And that can be done a couple different ways. I'm going to mention just Ohio has a very recently passed, within the last few months, a firefighter cancer presumption bill. And it basically says the following. Cancer contracted by a firefighter. Cancer contracted by a firefighter who's been assigned to at least 6 years, so there's your minimum, 6 years of hazardous duty as a firefighter, and I think a question will be what's hazardous duty, as a firefighter constitutes a presumption that the cancer was contracted in the course of and arising out of the firefighter's employment. If the firefighter was exposed to an agent classified by the International Agency for Research on Cancer or its successor organization as a group 1 or 2A carcinogen. And so, you know, there are a number you can look up what the group 1 or 2 carcinogens are, but the group 1, for example, includes things like asbestos, benzene,
any of the volatile
firefighters
agents?
Things would typically run into, yes. And some of the there's also mixtures under that, which everything from coal tars to certain types of dust, soot. Soot is one of the categories. So I think that we're going to find that, you know, we can establish that exposure if you are a firefighter who is actively engaged in firefighting. Now, in Ohio, again, there are certain things that that the employers can use to refute that presumption. And that would be that that outside of the scope of the firefighter's official duties, he or she's been exposed to cigarettes, tobacco products, or other conditions presenting a highly high risk for development of cancer. So, you know, if you're working outside of firefighting in an asbestos factory, for example, you're going to have a problem. If you're off duty in Ohio and you smoke cigarettes, that's, I think, going to really create a problem for you having the benefit of this law. Others were that the firefighter was not exposed to an agent classified as a group 1 or 2A carcinogen. So one of the things firefighters in Ohio, the departments are looking at doing is making sure when you go out to a fire that you start documenting that you've been exposed to various, soot, that you've been exposed to carbon monoxide, you've been exposed to hydrogen cyanide or potassium cyanide or whatever else you can physically meter to document that. Now, I'm not sure how that's going to apply for firefighters who've contracted cancer and don't have that documentation other than, you know, perhaps through eyewitnesses. But the next is that the firefighter had the cancer before he became a member of the department. or the firefighter 70 years of age or older. Some of the presumption does not apply if it's been more than 20 years, so he's last assigned to a hazardous job. And then they refer to what's a hazardous duty, and they list a federal code of regulation definition for that. I think the idea is outlined by you in the Washington State case is what they said is it's going to be a question of fact that at the end of the day, they let the case in Washington go to a jury, or should let the case go to a jury, and that it is the employer that has the burden of proof of rebutting that cancer was in fact caused by the job. So it's going to be a factual inquiry, and it's going to again come down to firefighters following healthy lifestyles, like you've indicated. Smoking's going to, in most states, or doing other things where you're exposing yourself to contaminants outside of your employment is going to create issues for you, again, particularly smoking. I think that there's a lot of these laws are new, and one of the things that I talked about before we went on the air was that there's a lot of case law that's still not yet developed. It's sort of like dealing with social media or case law on drones. It's all so new that we haven't developed a great body of law to provide guidance to us. In Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania just accepted a case for review on March 1st of this year. And the issues are, there are two issues that the Supreme Court are going to decide that arise out of a case from the city of Philadelphia. The first issue, as the court notes in a case of first impression, is whether or not the trial court committed an error by misinterpreting their rebuttable presumption law to require a firefighter diagnosed with cancer caused by a group 1 carcinogen to establish exposure to a specific carcinogen that caused his or her cancer in order to gain the rebuttable presumption provided by the law. So in other words, you have this whole list of group 1 carcinogens. Are you going to have to say, well, I was exposed to soot, or I was exposed to this? And the court's going to look at what is the amount of proof that the firefighter has to present at regarding the exposure to gain the advantage of that law. The second issue that the Supreme Court is going to address is whether or not the trial court committed an error by concluding that a legislatively created presumption of compensability may be competently rebutted by general causation opinion based entirely on epidemiology without any opinion specific to the firefighter claimant making the claim. So in other words, somebody's going to come in and say, I've got this type of cancer based upon my exposure to soot. They present, the employer presents contra evidence that says, well, that type of cancer is generally not exposed or contracted as a result of exposure to soot. It's contracted by some other, or it usually comes by some other means, and not looking at that firefighter's specific case, just going on generalities. And I don't know how the court's going to rule in that case, but again, I think across the country, courts tend to look at each other. They're not, a decision in Pennsylvania is not binding on the Supreme Court in Washington, but I think they will provide guidance to each other as this body of law is established. And so I get back to the same thing. I think regardless of where courts stand, they're going to want to see some type of evidence. They're going to want to see what the exposure was, and so I think it's up to departments to document that, and I think that it's going to be up to firefighters to make sure that they don't give the employer an opportunity to rebut based upon the employee's own actions. And again, it gets back to smoking. I've often said, why do we give our folks, our employees, air packs when, the first thing they do when they come out of the building is light up a cigarette. It's idiotic. So
absurd.
Those I think, you know, those are just people need to be aware. Fire departments need to look at their documentation. Individuals need to look at their personal health styles, their lifestyles. Thank you.
I agree. So the issue of documentation, I think, is paramount because, you know, for those states that don't have the presumptive illness legislation in place, yes, it is up to you to do that. So the question is, how do you do that? And, you know, much of it is this sort of an awareness of, you know, what, and you, I don't think you can depend on the department to provide a chronological order of every fire that you've been on. And so maybe a diary or a journal of those fires and potential exposures in, you know, a few short words for you to keep, you know, as part of your permanent file personally will help go a long way in doing the presumptions. If you're not in, you know, our states or my state that has presumptive legislation, but, you know, as we talked about, you know, it's an uphill battle regardless of whether you have a, you know, an employer that is in your favor, or whether you have the proper documentation or the law behind you. So that's the first thing. So documentation is one. The second
I'm going to stop you there because I think you and I agree and disagree on one point. I think if you have an employer who's willing to do this and you can talk the employer into it, I think in filling out your typical fire reports on the NIFRs, you ought to die. And that's one of the things we've been talking about is why not put on there that who was an interior firefighter or people at the scene, you know, heavy smoke condition, insulation involved in fire, asbestos present, you know, just listing as on part of the narrative of the report, those type of incidents to which your firefighters were exposed. And, you know, if you're really in a position where you can't, that either, you know, the person making the report won't do it, the fire department doesn't want to do it. Yeah, I think as a last resort, you're going to have to keep your own diary as you've advocated. I think that's where we agree. If you can't get the department to do that, then I think you have to go that route. But I really think that all departments and employees should really look at documenting those exposures. So that's my two cents there.
All right. Well stated. Yeah, having a you know, sort of a national database on NFERS would be, or NIFERS, as you say, from Ohio, is a basically a centralized reporting that can help, you know, you can generate statistics off that and look at the fires that you were on personally and help kind of create a documented trail. The other thing is, and we've, you know, I've said this in articles, and there's many of our firefighters that promote and push for fitness, is to get a medical physical periodically and check for signs of cancer. You know, go to your dermatologist and take a look at, you know, lesions or moles or things that are popping out on you. Have somebody check it out, because early detection and, you know, mitigation of those particular things is going to save your life in the long run. And then finally, there's a good article that was written probably 10 years ago or more by a friend of mine called Mario Trevino, who many of you may know, who actually listened to our show, was a fire chief pretty much all over the western state, so he's like the fire chief at large, developed cancer, and he tracked it back to a fire that happened in the 70s that I, as a paramedic student riding with the city of Seattle, was on that particular fire. And for me, it was, you know, a new firefighter and a paramedic student. It was probably one of the greatest adventures that I've ever been on. But according to Chief Trevino, they were trapped on an outside fire escape, copious amounts of smoke. This was in the early 70s, so we're all macho firefighters, didn't wear our breathing apparatus probably the way we should. We all smoked, and so what Chip talked about is, you know, going into a house fire, breathing two tanks of air coming out, sitting on a tailboard, smoking a cigarette is probably the most insane thing that we could do. But, you know, over time, you know, Chief Trevino developed cancer of the throat. And so he wrote an article called We Danced with the Devil. And it's probably one of the best articles you would want to read, talking about, you know, cancers in firefighters, the struggles that he had to go through in order to get coverage by, you know, the industrial Washington Industrial Insurance, because this is prior to the legislation, and you know, the sort of that sort of trials and tribulations of actually having a disease that can kill you in pretty darn short order. And so, in his case, the employer was against him. I have a very good friend of mine now who is in hospice, and our prayers are going to him. That's developed cancer that is systematic and has metastasized everywhere, and the employer is accepting, you know, the, part of this presumptive illness that, yes, you know, his exposure during his time with the fire department caused these sort of, you know, medical conditions, which, you know, in a couple of months or a month or so, he's not going to be with us. So I think it's important for us, not only as firefighters, but as people and with families, and Chip and I and our other cohort attorneys, it's important that you understand what your responsibilities are, what the department's responsibilities are, and if there are any enabling legislation in your state that helps you to prove your case that, you know, your illness that you contacted on the job is a presumptive illness. So I think that's it on that one. Yeah, any other comments?
No, I think that's good. I appreciate your statements relative to physical examinations. I think they're one of the things that fire departments can do to protect their members the most. We spend so much time on equipment, fire apparatus, and everything else, and we don't spend enough time just taking care of our own people. And I've seen too many great examples recently of where, whether it's cancers or heart conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, et cetera, have been caught as a result of a routine fire department physical. And so I've become a big proponent of them. In Ohio, I keep pointing out that medical annual medical certifications are required, although not often done. And so I think, you know, when we talk about workers' comp and all the other issues that are out there, we can save the state and we can save our departments a lot of time if we would just look at spending a little bit of money up front on the physicals rather than waiting until we have a, you know, major health illness that affects one of our members. So good point, John, that you brought up.
Well, thank you. So the next thing we're going to talk about is I think it's going to be the manufacturer's liability for apparatus. And again, this is another Washington State case. I think we're going to focus on Washington today, the other Washington, the good Washington.
We've got a couple of East Coast cases that we'll make up for. We'll balance the left coast off and bring up the East Coast a little bit. But
fair and balanced.
This is just a short point, and I'm going to try to do my best not to bring up the name of the manufacturer, or if I can, the department, other than you indicate it's already a state of Washington case. But what had happened is a manufacturer of a fire engine sold a fire engine to a fire department. And the fire department, the city, negotiated with the manufacturer not only for, you know, what the components were on the vehicle, and, you know, the city had made certain requests for things to be put on the vehicle, but they negotiated a contract. And through my clients, I have seen some contracts negotiated and others where they send, the manufacturer sends the form or standard contract out, and the fire department, city, village, township, whatever, just signs it, sends it back. And some of those contracts include terms that aren't, in my opinion, all that great for the political subdivision, but they're signed anyways. Well, in this case, there was a contract that was signed after being negotiated, and at some point after delivery of the apparatus, the employee of the fire department was injured on the job when he fell through a cross-lay cover on top of one of the fire engines. He fell several feet to the ground and was injured. And he ended up suing the fire department and the manufacturer in the state court. And that was eventually, I think, removed to federal court based upon what they call diversity, that the defendants, including the manufacturers, were based out of state. So the allegations were that the fire engine manufacturer, and the fire department itself negligently designed, manufactured, and retained the cross-lay cover and negligently failed to train, supervise, and warn the employees about its limitations. And again, that the manufacturer separately failed to properly design and manufacture the product, which was deemed, which the employee deemed to be unsafe and defective. So following the filing of that complaint, the fire department turned to the manufacturer and said, hey, we've been sued, and the claims here are that this product was defective, and you have to provide to us an attorney and to defend us and indemnify us, indemnify meaning, you know, pay for any judgments and costs. You have to indemnify us pursuant to the agreement we agreed to initially. And the manufacturer said, no, we don't have to do that, and they rejected what's called a tender, the request for the defense and the indemnity. And things went along. The fire department again asked the tender, saying, please defend us, and they did not. And so the case continues to go through the various hoops that lawsuits go through. And at some point down the road, the trial court determined that the fire department did not qualify as a product manufacturer or seller within Washington State's Liability Act. So the fire department was dismissed from the case. The case proceeded to a jury trial with the employee against the manufacturer of the fire engine. And the jury returned a verdict in favor of the employee in the amount of almost $600,000. Now, they found the manufacturer 60% at fault and the firefighter 40% at fault. So if it's in Ohio, if Washington's like Ohio, the 40% of that verdict would be deducted because of the firefighter's own negligence. So that ended that case. But what this the recent decision, again, this is a very end of – it's actually beginning of the year, end of the year 2016, beginning 2017. What had happened is the fire department then turned to the manufacturer and said, hey, we have about $300,000 plus in defense costs. I think it's $360,000. And said, you owe us that amount of money for our expenses to defend this case. And part of that money was paid by the fire department's insurer. So that part was also pursued. It was assigned to the insurance company of the fire department who then was trying to get their money back as well. So it proceeded to the court with the court having to determine under this contract who was responsible for the fire department's defense costs. Was it the fire department and its insurer, or was it a manufacturer based on the contract? And at the end of the day, the court looked at how the contract was written and said it only makes sense to interpret it in favor of the fire department against the manufacturer, and therefore we're going to find in the fire department and insurance companies a favor against the manufacturer. And that's what the trial court did, and it was a United States federal district court, and then the court addressed the issue of damages under Washington law to determine how that claimed $360,000, how much was the fire department and insurer actually entitled to, because they were asking some things that the court ultimately determined were not available under Washington law. And I guess the point that I wanted to bring up here is it's a good example of how careful you have to be to make sure that when you enter into a contract that you read it, that you understand it, and that it's reviewed, because you will find that indemnity, the hold harmless indemnity contracts are in many agreements that, or the provisions are in many agreements that fire departments sign. And it's one of the things that I'm not particularly thrilled about. I think they have to be mutual, but I think they have to be carefully written. And so this is just a recent example of a fire department actually benefiting from a well-written and negotiated contract.
Well, I think the other thing you and I chatted about a little bit before we started the show was, you know, the sort of the liability, the responsibility of the firefighters to understand sort of the structural weaknesses of certain, you know, points on the apparatus. And so if the cross-lay cover was a fabric, as an example, I think most reasonable firefighters wouldn't walk on it because there's no stable surface to do that. The newer cross-lay covers are aluminum. And so, they either spring up from one side like a they pop up like your laptop screen will pop up, or they're bifold, so they come up in both different directions. But when you get a new piece of apparatus, I think it's important that you inspect it, that you get your firefighters familiar with its limitations, and certainly it's not a giant toy that we can climb all over because it's inherently dangerous. I mean, to climb on top of a fire apparatus and doing the squirrel on this thing is when we do public open houses, we have children that come in and they're all over the fire apparatus. You know, I've seen them up on the hose bed. I've seen them on top of the crosslays. I've seen them up on if you have a mid-mount pump panel or up in there. And I'm thinking, you know, one kid falls off the apparatus and your department's going to shut down because of the liability. So I think it's important that safety first. Second is that when you get a new piece of apparatus, be, you know, fully aware of its capacity and capabilities, and certainly of its structural integrity. So don't be walking on top of things that either you didn't design, because most of the times when I worked on designing apparatus was done by the committee, and we looked at, you know, sort of reinforcing the areas that we know our firefighters are going to walk on. Like, so they'll lay on the crosslays, or they'll sit on the crosslay, or they'll kneel on the crosslay cover to load the hose bits. And so we want to make sure that the platforms that they're working on are as stable as possible, and I think that's the responsibility of the organization and certainly of the manufacturer to make sure that those areas that we know we're going to get walked on and stressed on, that they're as secure as possible. And then the other is I totally agree with you, Chip. I think that the contract review is important, that you have, you know, a second or third set of eyes on the agreement that you get, because they'll come to you in a boilerplate fashion. And the boilerplate fashion and those contracts are written for the manufacturer. They protect the manufacturer, and they don't protect your organization. So don't just, if you're a commissioner listening to this, or if you're a fire chief listening to this, and you look at contracts, read the contract, get your attorney to take a look at it, because those contracts always favor the manufacturer, and they don't favor you.
Well, and I'll give you the biggest example that I see, and it drives me crazy. And I find that the manufacturers are generally willing to sit down and talk to you about, you know, what provisions are willing to amend and which ones they're not going to. And one that's in every one of them says that in the event of a dispute, we are going to any disputes will be filed in a court located here. In the court that is chosen is always where the manufacturer's headquarters is located or their principal place of business is located. So it's in Wisconsin or Florida or Pennsylvania or, you know, Illinois or wherever else the manufacturer might be. And it's convenient for that company. The juries are going to know the company, the other company employees or may work for the employer. You know, it's the home turf. And why would, if you have a dispute with the manufacturer, you want to have to hire lawyers located in some far state to defend a case and you have to go there and testify when that manufacturer is coming to you to sell you a product? You know, in my case, I've got a manufacturer that's coming from wherever, to Ohio and wants to cut a deal in Ohio. I'm not going to, you know, California or Washington or Maine or Florida. They're coming here because they want my money. So if you want my money and you're going to deliver a product here and an agreement signed here in Ohio, I expect if we're going to have a dispute, we're going to file it. It's going to be filed in court in Ohio. Now, if you want to remove it to federal court because you think you're going to get hometown, and that's why federal courts have diversity jurisdiction, so the out-of-town defendant can get what they believe is a more fair shake from a federal judge, fine. You can do that. But we're not. I'm not going to travel, you know, 10, 15, 20 hours, 30 hours to address a dispute. And that's one of the big ones that I look at. And anybody who's purchasing anything, whether it's air packs, fire engines, turnout gear, if you're going to sign an agreement with somebody, you better have a provision in there that says where this case is going to be, any disputes are going to be litigated. And some of them have mandatory arbitration provisions in them, and you have to decide whether that's something you want to do as well. And again, you can go down through the list. As you've said, we both have reiterated or emphasized that you need to talk to your local counsel. So.
Amen. And I'm glad you brought up the arbitration clause, because we see a lot of arbitration, you know, clauses in there because, it favors the manufacturer. And we also, for those of you who have credit cards, most of you have arbitration clauses in your credit card terms and provisions as well, and those are not to your advantage. So you don't have a lot of choice. You don't negotiate terms and conditions and provisions of a credit card. So just be aware that when you're kind of in the driver's seat, that you do take the time to review the contracts that you get for your fire apparatus, and also, you know, doing building construction and those sorts of things. So, all right, I think we have time for one more, sir.
Other than
a defense attorney's pants catching on fire, what else we got? Which I think is
I've actually got two. One is we can do these relatively quickly. Again, a lot of these are recent. That's our theme tonight is recent case law update. The case of Crown versus Danby Fire District, which is a January 2017 case, rises out of the Northern District of New York. And this is, in a nutshell, it's an employee who was disciplined, and after he received his discipline, he sued the individuals and the department, the municipality that provided the discipline. And one of the things he claimed was that there was a violation of his civil rights for violating his constitutional rights relating to free speech or, you know, First Amendment protected speech. And I don't need to get into all the details of this. The court at the end of the day threw out some, agreed with others, so at the trial court. This was a higher court decision. But what the court wrote, this is a Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision. What I think is really important to note here out of this case deals with explaining the protection of the First Amendment. And I'm going to read the quote from this case, and I'll omit the other cases it references. So I'm going to just read from this case, and it cites a lot of other case law here. It says, our precedent has long established that a firefighter's criticisms of a fire department for deficiencies in training, discipline, and morale, and for limitations on access to public records are protected matters of public concern, at least insofar as the criticism relate to the department generally rather than to the plaintiff specifically. And so it goes on to discuss whether or not the firefighter speech are protected, because in this case there were a number of criticisms raised about records as well as the department's functioning. And the court once again reaffirmed that somebody who makes those type of allegations has protection of the First Amendment. And the case then becomes, this case then centered upon whether or not the firefighter's alleged actions outside of his criticisms would warrant discipline, or whether he was just being retaliated against for his criticisms. The department took the position that the firefighter employee had done enough other bad things that they could discipline him and be justified for disciplining him, notwithstanding the alleged protected First Amendment cases. So the point that I wanted to raise just from this recent case is that when you have an employee who is critical of the department and at the same time does something that warrants discipline, you have to be very careful, very cautious in rendering the discipline, because it is likely that an employee who's going to be critical of a department will thereafter file a First Amendment claim saying that his speech is protected and the department retaliated against him. And the courts are going to find the critical comments to be protected speech. Doesn't mean that the employee can't be disciplined, but it's just a caution that you're going to be set up in those cases. So
yeah,
that's the recent thoughts from the Danby Fire District case.
Well, I think that's a good point, because I think that when we don't do discipline very well, and a lot of it has to do with we don't do it very often. So when we do it, we do a fairly horrible job of it, unless we are in an organization that has a lot of discipline issues going on, and that's another issue, or you hire outside resources to do your discipline for you. But a lot of times we do discipline in the heat of the moment, and so we're pissed off that something occurred. The employee's been a bad actor for a period of time, and we just want to get rid of them. So we pull the trigger sooner than later, instead of doing a complete investigation and actually thinking about the issue that Chip brought up, is that, is my speech, protected? That's the first thing. And second of all, are you disciplining me because I'm a horrible firefighter, or are you disciplining me because I said something against the department, which is, protected speech? So, and sometimes, and I honest to God, firefighters are really smart. And so they may set up a scenario that you get suckered into doing one action because of, repeated violations of policy or whatever, but the real issue is the hidden issue, which is you've infringed on my right of free speech and I'm going to sue you. Not for the termination part, which is, not a big deal, but for my violation of my rights under the First Amendment. So I think that smart, and when I do a class on, a little brief thing on discipline, and Kurt does a pretty complete job for, I think he has a 2 or 3 day class on discipline, but you talk about sometimes your firefighters will set you up to fail. And so it's imperative that you understand what the facts are, what all the issues are. And so when you're going to discipline somebody for policy violations and they're saying bad things about your department, I think you need to get somebody in to do a First Amendment analysis of, is the speech protected or not? And then you can proceed on. So, and I think a lot of times departments are afraid to discipline people because of they're really unsure what the process is, or the person is a person of color, or their gender, because they throw what I call the race card down or the gender card down, that you can't fire me because I'm in a protected class. And I always say that's a bunch of hooey, that we'll work this thing through because of, repeated policy violations. But you got to understand that if they start talking about your department either on Facebook or in the public or areas of, public interest, then you need to do the First Amendment analysis and then make sure that you don't get either a retaliation claim against you or your organization. And that takes time. So don't pull the trigger too fast.
Agreed. John, I've got one last case that's also a First Amendment case. This is also we've had two West Coast cases. We did the East Coast case, so I'm gonna end up with another East Coast case. And this
fair and balanced. Fair and balanced.
Yes. That's what we try to do. Present both sides of the issues. This one, we've talked in the past about firefighters who are on the scene and have a member of the public attempt to photograph what they're doing. And typically it's the police officers, and police officers seize cameras. We've seen a few limited examples in the fire world But most of the time it's police officers who are conducting investigations or something else. Somebody's videoing them, and they grab the camera, and there's a number of cases out there that say that's a violation of a person's First Amendment rights. This case in New Hampshire is a little different in that we have a member of the public who responds to accident scenes, and this is a person who typically submits photos online to a fire-based newspaper for publication. And at one point was a member of a fire department, but over the course of decades was no longer certified, no longer affiliated with the department, but got what was described as a repurposed ambulance to make it look like a fire department vehicle, and replaced the red lights with some yellow lights, although it had some red flashing lights in the rear, had photographer signs on the vehicle, had turnout gear with a black helmet that said photographer on it, had a pass that said photographer, ended up at a fatal automobile accident scene, was asked to move the vehicle, and the incident commander thought that the photographer was with one of the other fire departments, did not realize that he was an individual photographer. And there was some question as to what he was doing. And this person, because of his gear and vehicle, was able to gain access to a scene that the average John Q. public would not be able to. And a state trooper came on the scene and started asking this person questions about what he was doing and who he was with. And I don't know that the individual was completely straightforward with the trooper, according to the opinion. But at the end of the day, the trooper ends up arresting the photographer on a number of different charges, including entering an emergency scene, unlawfully entering an emergency scene, unlawfully using emergency lights, impersonating emergency rescue provider, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole lot of charges. At the end of the day, the photographer pled guilty to only one charge, which was improper use the photographer pled to improper use of red lights. Now, during this investigation, the trooper seized the camera. Then gave the camera back after a day, but took as evidence the card from the camera. The court questioned why he didn't seize the ambulance, the turnout gear, and everything else, and the trooper said he wasn't really worried about that because it's harder to dispose of evidence. But the photographer ends up pleading guilty to that charge and then turns around and sues the trooper for violation of his First Amendment civil rights. And the court does an analysis on qualified immunity before they really address the First Amendment right. And the qualified immunity indicates to be held liable under civil rights violation, a plaintiff must demonstrate that the public employee, in this case the trooper, should have known that his conduct was violating an established constitutional right. Now, there are cases out there that would suggest that taking a camera from a member of the press would violate a constitutional right, a First Amendment right. But the issue in this case dealt with the photographer's own conduct at the scene, because the question was whether or not the photographer was lawfully behaving, whether his actions were lawful at the scene. And if they weren't, he would lose the First Amendment protection. And so with the court, at the end of the day, the court, in a sort of a entertaining decision, said that the plaintiff photographer failed to establish that the law was clear at the time all these incidents took place. And so ends in the case and says, so there's no confusion about our holding on the First Amendment claim. We do not say whether the trooper's actions did not violate the photographer's First Amendment rights, nor do we say what a complete compendium of the First Amendment rights for news gatherers is or should be. Because, again, just to reiterate our prior discussions on this show, that many members of the public can be members of the press by taking photos. So it's a really broad definition of a member of the press. So court continues. We only say that the photographer failed to identify clearly established law as of the date of this incident, showing beyond debate that the trooper's specific acts violated the First Amendment. And the court ends, and that is that. So I think the issue here is that under these facts and circumstances, the court granted relief to the trooper, saying that given the particular behavior of the photographer, there was not necessarily the trooper would not have known that what he had done in taking the camera, and I should add he sought advice from the prosecutor, as we advocated in the last case that we just discussed, but that he would not have known that his actions would have violated the First Amendment. But they didn't also say that his actions did not violate the First Amendment. They just said we don't even have to get to that. So here's, given the facts of the case that are so favorable to the trooper in terms of what this individual did on the scene, his argument, the photographer's argument, said even if I did all these bad things, that would not give you a right to limit my right to take pictures, even though I had, you know, the gear and I had this vehicle that was improperly marked. So I think that the cases against the fire personnel, fire police, fire officers, police officers for seizing cameras, that law is alive and well. And this case just provides an additional caution just how risky it can be to try to limit members of the press. And so you have to be careful there. And I think you have to work, you know, I think one of the things is working with the press as good as your I don't want to say friends, but certainly as colleagues, knowing that they have a job to do, and you have to, rather than trying to fight them, it's, you know, how can we work with these people to provide them what they need? And you just have to be reasonable in terms of your place restrictions, in terms of where you place the press, but it's always good to have somebody try to work with them so you don't have these issues arise. So that's just my last subject comment on a recent case.
Well, I think that's a good one, only because I know that there's several examples that have been caught on tape, actually. I think the last one I remember is in Miami-Dade County, where they had a plane crash or some pretty significant event. And they had a news photographer there with a camera, and either a captain or one of their fire personnel came out and was essentially forcing the cameraman away from the scene. Whereas the cameraman says, I have my First Amendment right to be here to do the photography. And then there was a sequela of, you know, discipline, and I don't think they ever got to a lawsuit. But certainly it was an embarrassment to the organization to have this fire personnel come out and not even understand what the rights of, access are under the First Amendment to the news media. And so, you know, I always say, I think your department needs to have a PIO. The PIO can be either informally or formally trained. The PIO will make that relationship with the media. And if you do have an event, then there's the media area. The PIO addresses the media, allows pictures to be taken, maybe close up. I know that yesterday or the day before they had a fire in Seattle where they staged the media away, that it was a fire fatality. And so the media requested access around to the back of the house because the whole scene wasn't, you know, the fire department's responsibility. And so the fire department controlled the access. They allowed media to go back to take pictures, you know, in the sort of the common areas or the public areas in an alley that depicted the back of the house. And they created a news story. It looks good for the city. The report, current news, nobody's getting into the media's face saying you can't be here, because the media is inevitably going to say, I have a right. I have a right to be here. And, you know, at the end of the day, they do. And so, like I think Chip was alluding to, media could be your best friend or your worst enemy. And I think it's important that you cultivate a relationship before the event occurs and not, creating policy during the event. So I think that was a great case. It sounds like sort of a fire buff that took advantage of surplus sales, and that the issue is that I think everything happened the way it was supposed to happen. You know, we actually have a caller. Now, this may be, I don't know who it is. I'm going to find out. So let me see. We're going live.
Hi, hello.
Radio show. Yes, sir. Who's this? You have a question for the attorneys.
This is Will. I just joined in. I just had a little something to say. I have something on my mind.
So does it have to do with fire service law?
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit with fire, kind of.
All right. Well, we're ending your conversation here. Thank you very much. Have a great night. Jeez, I thought that was Brad's mother calling in. I don't know. Anyway, our caller is no longer with us. And so any final words?
No, you know, I think, Chip. Again, that the law, people have to understand, I think, that the law is different across the country. We have general principles that may go from state to state, but, you know, unlike search techniques or, you know, how to cut a roll down gate, it becomes a very geographically trying subject matter to master. And so, you know, we provide general outcomes of cases here. We try to emphasize that, you know, while we're discussing case law, you really need to discuss a lot of these issues with your legal counsel, your local legal counsel that knows the law in your own state. One of the things we try to emphasize, and we've not discussed so much tonight in terms of specific policies, but one of the things we have advocated in the past is a need to have certain core or critical policies in place for departments that will, if implemented and followed, will reduce potential for liability and will make departments operate more efficiently. So, you know, I think that those are some of the things that our listeners should look toward to make sure what they're doing. And we'll hit additional subjects on our next show. But reminders, you've already said at the outset that we will all be at FDIC in Indianapolis. I know you address training issues. I address First Amendment. Brad's usually addressing critical policies that fire department needs, and Kurt addresses a whole host of topics from drones to firefighter discipline, et cetera. So we try to cover the works, and it is one of the few places that you could get actually good legal advice as opposed to the people in your own firehouse who give you the firehouse lawyer version that isn't always reliable. And in Indianapolis, it only costs you a beer to receive that advice. So other than that, that's all I've got.
Well, I appreciate that. FDIC, the week of April 24 till I think the 29, iWoman's Conference is the Sunday and the Monday, the 24th as well. So I think we have two fantastic conferences that are going on. Certainly iWoman's Conference will be well attended. It's you know, open. You know, you got to pay, you know, the money to go there, but I think it would be well worth going because I'm speaking on discrimination issues. There's two or three other people that are talking about building issues, fire, you know, hands-on training and those sorts of things. So I think it's a great, great conference, and I always look forward to going there. And I, just for a cheap pitch, I'm speaking actually not on training liabilities this year, but I'm teaching on high-risk legal issues for the fire department. It's an afternoon class, the four-hour class, pre-con, on Monday afternoon on the 24th. So when's your class, Mr. Chip, sir?
Mine is, I believe, Friday, Friday morning. So I'm towards the end of the conference, which means I'll have to be on my good behavior towards the end of the week, which is hard to do.
Which, and I want to put a cheap pitch in for Dr. Murphy's behavioral health seminar episode is on Friday as well. It's in the afternoon. So those of you who are interested in behavioral health issues, certainly a big issue in our fire service now, her class is on Friday afternoon. And there are hundreds of other equally as impressive classes at FDIC this year, April 24th to the 29th, 2017. And without further ado, we're done. So thank you very much, Chip. I appreciate
your
legal
analysis.
Thanks,
John. Take care. And thanks for our, as Brad always reminds, our millions and millions of listeners. We appreciate everybody who tunes in either live or in the audio replay. So thanks again.
All right. Have a good night. Be safe.